Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio.
We go out to the phones and tag in Gary McCarthy, former Chicago Police Superintendent, now running for mayor in Chicago, taking on Rahm Emanuel. The website, garyformayor.com, G-A-R-R-Y. Mr. McCarthy, welcome to Legal Face Off.
Thanks for having me.
Gary, given your experience in law enforcement, including serving as Chicago Police Department Superintendent from 2011 until 2015, public safety is obviously one of your big priorities. Where has Rahm Emanuel failed in this area? And tell us what you do in the first 50 days of a McCarthy administration to reduce crime.
Well, the politics has ruled the day in the police department here. It's a political organization. It needs to be a performance-based organization. And this was evident subsequent to my termination. City Hall came into the department, rewrote policies, literally conducting a witch hunt, because minor disciplinary cases that were in the pipeline while I was superintendent resulted in people being forced to resign after I was terminated. And that was all because the mayor thought that it was politically astute for him to be tough on the police, not recognizing the fact that in 2016, less than half of 1% of the shootings in the city were police-related. And by the way, it doesn't mean that all of them were bad shootings. Some of them were very much justified. So let me put that another way. In 2016, had nobody been shot by a police officer in the city of Chicago, 4,300 people still got shot. So the police aren't the problem in this city. The criminals are. And if a police officer violates the law, they need to be prosecuted like any other American citizen or any other person in our society. Let's put it that way. And if they violate policy, they need to be disciplined or retrained. But you don't just wipe out a generation in a department and expect it to be performing at the same level that it was.
So what steps would you take, Gary, to reduce crime as part of your administration?
Well, the same steps that we took when I was the superintendent. We created probably the most comprehensive gang violence reduction strategy in the country, which has to do with intelligence. We recorded every gang in the city, every gang turf that they believed that they owned. I always say that because I'm not willing to grant them any turf. That belongs to the people of Chicago, and all the membership and all the disputes. Because what happens is somebody gets shot in one neighborhood and all the police go to that shooting. Well, that's not the right thing to do, because you need to know if that person who got shot is a gang member, what gang they're a member of, and what gang they're in conflict with. And you deploy your resources to where the other gang is, and we were picking up guns and stopping the retaliation shootings. And that was done based on data and proactive police work. But with it, we were also doing a number of non-enforcement strategies that the mayor has cut funding on. For instance, we were taking gang members who were on parole, working with parole, bringing them into meetings, and having conversations with them and giving them an opportunity to get out of the life through social services, jobs, getting identification cards so that they could move forward. And this was a program that we were running in, I think it was about 9 districts in the city, that's now been cut to 4. And that was done because money's going to other places. Money is not going to social services. Here's the bottom line, what's happening in the city. We're losing our tax base because we're losing population. We've been losing population for the last 10 years, the only major urban center in the country, I believe, that's lost population over the last 10 years. Who are we losing? We're losing middle-class African-Americans from the South and the West Side. Why are we losing them? We're losing them because of gun violence. Because we're losing them, we're losing our tax base. And because we're losing our tax base, we're pulling social services and closing schools. Where? On the South and the West Side, which is causing more gun violence. We've thrown ourselves into a huge cycle here that needs to be addressed in a different fashion, more holistic fashion. There's something called collective efficacy, where we can actually, government We can't fix society's problems. We can't create parenting. But what we can do is create the conditions where that can actually happen. It's called collective efficacy. It's something that we've been doing for a very long time that we're not doing here in Chicago.
Gary, development
in the neighborhoods where we need to have development. We need to bring back trade schools, and we need to give small businesses tax breaks to go to those neighborhoods to create the market for young men and women with those trades to come out and have jobs. That's not happening.
Gary, picking up on that point, you will inevitably have to answer Emanuel's claims that he has done a lot for economic development, especially in luring corporate headquarters back to the city. Certainly if Amazon decides to relocate their headquarters and brings 50,000 jobs to Chicago before the election, that'll be, I think, an asset that Mayor Emanuel can leverage in his campaign. How do you answer that? And also, what other steps would you take to create economic conditions, not just in neighborhoods like Streeterville and Lincoln Park, but in some of the neighborhoods that you mentioned on the south and west sides?
See, that's exactly what I'm talking about. The economic development that's happened in the city is exclusively downtown. There's cranes in the air downtown. That's great. And there's unions who are giving him money as a result of the fact that there's cranes in the air downtown. The south and the west side and the other neighborhoods are drying up. And exactly what I just said, we need to bring back trade schools because we need carpenters, electricians, auto mechanics, and so on and so forth. And then we can take and put those folks to work in those neighborhoods where we have these deserts of abandoned housing, redevelop those for affordable housing for individuals, and give the small businesses tax breaks to go to those neighborhoods, not just give the Amazons tax breaks to come here. And just think about the fact that if Amazon does come here, who are they going to hire? It's not going to be people who live downtown because they're not going to be able to afford to do that. They're going to be hiring people from the suburbs. They're not going to bring job development to the people who need it the most on the south and the west side.
So, Gary, last question. You were born in New York, and you spent your adult life there and in Newark until you moved to Chicago back in 2011 when you were hired. Do you think that voters will elect someone like you who's a relative newcomer to the city, especially given that in this mayoral race there are so many contenders this year, many of whom have deep ties to the city?
Well, so I can tell you this. First of all, my answer that I love to give to that one is show me the 78th neighborhood in Chicago called Winnetka. It doesn't exist. And I challenge anybody from Chicago to look at my Bronx neighborhood and tell me what it reminds you of, because it reminds me of Chicago. So that's first of all. Second of all, I'm not leaving this place. And where I was born, I don't think makes a difference, except for the fact that the answer doesn't fly to me, well, that's the way we've always done it here. If you always do what you always did, you always get what you always got. And right now, what we've got is failure. 7 years of failure in this city, it's got to get turned around. There has to be a different method to address it. There has to be business management of City Hall, which is not happening. We've got to stop doing everything politically. If anybody ran their business the way that Rahm Emanuel runs City Hall, they'd be out of business in a heartbeat. It's really evident, and it's failing.
Gary, have you dropped the Yankees or the Mets in favor of one of our Chicago teams? That's what our listeners really want to know.
Yeah, well, you know what? The short answer to that is when I got here, I told Jerry Reinsdorf that I was going to root for the White Sox because I'm an American League guy growing up in the Bronx. And he said, Gary, I'll take you for 155 games a year as long as we're not playing the Yankees. But I met Joe Maddon, and this guy has won me over in a heartbeat. What a wonderful man. If he's in a room with 200 people, he makes everybody there feel like they're the most important person in the room. So I root for our Chicago teams all the time. I can't give up on my Yankees and Giants, though. At the end of the day, I'm still watching what they're doing, but I'm rooting for Chicago.
Well, maybe we'll see a Yankees-Cubs World Series. That's Gary McCarthy.
I was dying for that last year. That would have been so great.
Gary McCarthy, he's running for mayor of Chicago. The website is garyformayor.com. Gary, thanks for joining us on WGN, and please come back
Absolutely.
When we have a mayoral debate, we'd love to have you back on Legal Face-Off.
Thanks, Gary.
Absolutely, I will be. And all our policies are going up on that website so we can expand on these things we discussed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
You can follow Legal Face-Off on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook and always find the show on iTunes. Search for Legal Face-Off. Up next, a conversation with a man who's run for mayor before. He's doing it again here in 2018, Paul Vallis, VallisForAllChicago.com.
Paul, thanks for joining Legal Face-Off.
Well, thanks for having me.
Paul, it's great to have you on with us. So last month, you announced that you are running for mayor, along with a whole slew of others. You obviously have a very long history of public service, including as the former CEO of the Chicago Public Schools and as the former City Hall Budget Director. What made you decide to throw your hat into the ring?
Well, I think the city's in deep trouble. We have more murders in Chicago than L.A. and New York combined. The schools have been in constant crisis. You can just tick off the crisis from, and I think the most significant crisis the schools is facing has been a significant reduction in enrollment, which obviously impacts everything. But from those, you know, from the mismanaged closing of schools to the controversial soups contract, $20 million contract that landed a superintendent, as well as a vendor or vendors in jail, to the to the most recent controversy, their failure to respond to accusations and evidence of sexual abuse. It's been just one crisis after another. And I also think I'm also running because I really think we're rapidly becoming the tale of two cities. I mean, there are the development in and around the Loop and within three or four mile radius of the Loop has been significant. That development began long before Rahm Emanuel became mayor, and other areas of the city have gone virtually ignored. I mean, there are areas of the city on the west side and the south side that have not recovered from the Great Recession, and in fact, some areas on the west side haven't recovered from the 1968 riots. And when you consider that, I think Chicago is close to the bottom among the big cities in terms of employment growth, but that the city's property values have declined by 17% since their pre-recession levels, where in contrast, the property values nationwide have grown by 7 or 8%. I mean, that is not a healthy sign. That impacts everything. It expands the tax burden to the remaining property owners and to the remaining property taxpayers. And so the decline in city enrollment, the decline in the value of property, the escalating crime rate, the inequities in the distribution of city resources, and of course, uncertainty and the controversies surrounding the schools.
Let's jump in on that, Paul.
Sitting out there, I think all those problems have motivated me to get into this race.
Let's jump in a little deeper on the school issue, because obviously that is one that you're intimately familiar with as an issue, but also you mentioned the daily news right now about the sexual abuse scandal. And in particular, one of the issues is that the law department is charged with investigating these issues, but they're also responsible for defending the district if abused students file lawsuits. There's news this morning that that will be taken away from them. But what does that say about the overall culture at CPS, and what are your feelings about how that lands on the mayor's doorstep?
Well, look, you know, the mayor's had four superintendents in 7 years. What does that tell you? You recently had this the mayor lashing out against Aramark because 73% of their schools failed their cleanliness test. So they had basically 73% failure rate. But yet that same week, they get a $267 million contract extension. I think it lays right on the mayor's desk. I'd like to see the emails between City Hall and the school district in terms of the correspondence that was going on during the period within which the Tribune was doing this investigation. I mean, the city didn't start acting. Didn't start aggressively acting until after the Tribune had presented their findings to the a school district CEO. So for the Emanuel administration, it's all about politics. It's all about managing the issue, the issue of the day, staying on top of things politically. It's not, they put politics over policy, and I think it's reflected in their mismanagement of the schools, their mismanagement of their budget, their mismanagement of city economic development resources. So I think that it was more about trying to suppress the story and then trying to spin the story. And now, of course, they're obviously reacting, but only after. Look, the inspector general had asked for that investigatory power days, if not a week before. City Hall finally came around to it and had a big press conference indicating that now the inspector general will be conducting these investigations. They should have had the inspector general investigate these issues when they first got the intel that these things were going on in these schools in the first place. And it's clear that a lot of this information was circulating, that there was a lot of there was certainly enough information to warrant a serious investigation or a serious reassessment of how they investigate these cases within the school district long before the Tribune story ever ran. So, I think the buck stops in the mayor's office. He appoints the CEO. He appoints the board. It's this handpicked board. And I think the responsibility lays with him.
So, Paul, why don't you talk to us for a minute about public safety and what you think we could do better in that regard?
Well, I think, and a lot of this is based on things that we did, many, many, many years ago. I believe that public safety, when it comes to the schools, is a 24/7 responsibility. Our approach was, first of all, to have a separate police command. Now, the Chicago Police Command, but I have all the police officers in the schools and the off-duty police officers who work in the schools under a separate commander, so that these officers were really kind of schooled and trained in how to deal with students and how to interact with students. So they became known to the community. They became known to the kids, and the kids in turn, they're familiar with the kids. It was a way to gather intelligence, and it was a way with that separate police command, when we had incidents involving students who were at risk, not only in the schools, but also at risk in their homes, in the community, what we would do was we would have 24-hour, 7-day-a-week intervention. So in other words, if we had a student who was a victim of violence on a Saturday or Sunday, if we have students who were being intimidated by gangbangers, if we had students who were being constantly bullied, we would do something about it. We would get the information, and we would dispatch either our youth outreach officers or we would file a report with the police department, and we would investigate. So our approach was to be very, very aggressive. And I think what they need to do is they need to institute an infrastructure, a public safety infrastructure that provides these type of protections and provides these type of crisis intervention services. Let me tell you what that would consist of. The first thing it would consist of would be reconsolidating the police command so that you have a single police commander and that the police officers who work in the schools are trained to work in the schools, because this would ensure that there are the police resources available and that the police are there. They're gathering intelligence and they're obviously working with the students and they know how to interact with the students. The second thing that would be required is that you set up a mechanism that allows information to be accessed. In our day, it was 24/7 student hotlines. You would call in, provide the information or provide the lead, or usually anonymously, about what you had heard or what was going on or over a hotline. Now you can do it through social media. There are social media platforms that you could set up, which would allow information to be accessed, intelligence to be gathered, and then a determination to be made what to do with that intelligence. So setting up that reporting, that 24/7 reporting apparatus would be something that you would need to do. And then the third thing that you would need to do is to have a series of protocols. First of all, I'm glad that the inspector general is going to be doing these investigations. But I think if you have a self-contained police unit under a single command in the schools that specializes in student safety, and if you have the appropriate intergovernmental links with the Department of Children and Family Services, then when something happens that impacts students, you automatically, the police, it triggers, if appropriate, a police investigation. It triggers activating that relationship with the Department of Children and the State Department of Children and Family Services, so that the appropriate agencies are conducting these investigations and that you're having the appropriate follow through. So this is not rocket science, you know. And what's absolutely critically important is training. Principals and teachers down to custodial staff and support staff all need consistent and constant and repetitive training in how to deal with these situations, when things are brought to their attention, what to do, how to react, and not only in cases of sexual abuse, but also in cases where students are being intimidated or students are being threatened. When we created our hotlines in the various school districts I've operated, we used to get information about who was bringing a gun to school, or who was trying to get a gun into school, or who was suicidal, or who was which students were having serious drug problems and opioid problems. So we were constantly gathering information that we could respond to. So making sure that you have a highly trained police unit working in the schools, number one. Number two, making sure that you've got a reporting infrastructure so that information can flow, intelligence can be gathered, and determinations made about what the right interventions. And number three, you know, having the right type of relationship so that you have the appropriate entities investigating incidents or investigating risks being posed to students, whether it's happening on the school grounds or whether it's happening on the weekends or at home. Having the capacity to do that, I think those are the fundamental things that you can do to make the schools not only safe from sexual predators, but also to make the schools and the children safe from gangbangers or from threats in the community with the proliferation of guns and just the elevation of crime, which is victimizing so many of our young people throughout the city.
Paul, last question. We've only got about 2 minutes left on Legal Face-Off. Okay. We just saw a deposition testimony released this week of Mayor Emanuel and Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson in the Quintonio LaGreer lawsuit that goes to trial on Monday. Superintendent Johnson said under oath that he has never heard an officer talk about a code of silence. What are your thoughts on a code of silence, and bigger picture, what would you do as mayor to improve relations between the community and police?
Oh, goodness gracious, 2 minutes?
I know, that's not a lot of time on a big issue.
One. Do I believe that there's a code of silence? No, there's four police officers in my family, and one who passed away, who was a three-decade detective, Area 1 homicide, Pete Felzer. So, no, I mean, I don't believe that there's a code of silence. I think in very large organizations, there are going to be people who are not suited for those jobs and who basically act inappropriately. And I think, sometimes in a small minority of cases, I think there may be some individuals who are reluctant to talk about other individuals. I think the larger the organization, the greater likelihood that you'll have a larger number of people who basically maybe do not act responsibly. Either they're not reacting responsibly because of their actions, or they're not reacting responsibly because they're not disseminating the information. But is there some sort of understated or unofficial code of silence? No, I don't believe that for 1 minute. I think what you've got to do, you have to understand what's happened to this police department. This police department has been decimated. It's been decimated by budget cuts. The mayor promised 1,000 police officers. I think they eliminated close to 2,000 vacancies. The detectives division was literally cut in half. We went from 1,200 detectives to 600 detectives. Now they're rapidly trying to get back up to that 1,200 number. That's why we're only solving one out of every six homicides. And the supervisory staff was gutted. And the training has been deplorable, totally inefficient. So when you have overworked police officers, because you don't have a number of police officers, you don't have beat integrity, you're moving police officers all around the city. When you don't have the right supervisory infrastructure, in other words, you don't have one sergeant for every 10 officers, you have one sergeant for every 30 officers, you don't have enough training officers, and when you don't have enough police, police support resources in place. You have overworked detectives. You have exhausted detectives handling dozens and dozens of new cases every month. I mean, that leads to a breakdown. It leads to a breakdown in efficiency. It leads to a breakdown in accountability. Building up police strength also means building the infrastructure so that you have the type of command and control that ensures not only do you have effective policing, but you have accountable policing. And I think that's what's happened. And finally, when you wait literally 5 to 6 years to start equipping your officers with tasers and then training them on how to use the tasers, not to mention giving them the type of training that they need so that there are clear alternatives to the use of deadly force. I mean, this is absolutely irresponsible. So I think at the heart of the problem when it comes to the police is the fact that they've been under-resourced, they've been under-supervised, they've been under-trained, and I think that's been a big part of the problem.
ValisForAllChicago.com. Paul Vallis, the election is in 8 months. We'd love to have you back on for a candidate forum between now and the election.
Well, thank you. I look forward to that. Anytime.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
We start with Lori Lightfoot, LightfootForChicago.com, on running against the mayor in Chicago.
Thanks for joining us, Lori. So early last week, you had announced that you're running for mayor against Rahm Emanuel. This is on the heels of your resignation as the president of the Chicago Police Board, which is a position that the mayor had placed you in. What made you decide that this is the right time to throw your hat into what has become a very crowded ring for mayor?
Right. There's a lot of folks who are stepping up to the tee. Well, I just fundamentally came to believe some time ago that the city was going in the wrong direction. And I kept waiting for the mayor to step up and address, I think, some of the significant challenges that we have, both at an individual and neighborhood level. And I just didn't see that leadership happening. You know, things like, for example, the fact that we have a very regressive tax burden that places undue pressure and burden on middle and lower income families and individuals. The fact that we have obviously violence is a significant issue in our city, and we need to have a comprehensive plan to address not just the immediate vestiges and manifestations of the violence, but really what's going on at the neighborhood level that is driving the violence. In my view, violence is a symptom of a community that's in distress. We have things like 40% of African-American children live in poverty. We have unemployment. We have lack of jobs and other opportunities. So we need a comprehensive plan to deal with that, and that will absolutely help drive down the violence. But is that and other issues that led me to feel like there needed to be an articulation of a new progressive course for the city?
Lori, picking up on one of the points you raised, there's a recent study that you, in fact, have referenced in your campaign thus far, that on the west side of Chicago, life expectancy is 69 compared to 85 years for someone who's living in the Loop, which is 7 L stops away.
Right.
How do you, as mayor, plan to bridge some of that gap, some of that disparity?
I think, frankly, we follow the model of West Side United on a range of different issues, but let me talk specifically about that. The hospitals, the Affordable Care Act mandated that hospitals who provide charity work must do a community needs assessment. So there's a whole host of data, literally stretching from the north to the south, east and west, about what's happening at the community level. And this is obviously from a healthcare perspective, but the information that's there is valuable and can be used. Those institutions and individuals on the west side came together, united, to address a specific community need. But unfortunately, the city's not at the table in that initiative. But if we took that model and used data-driven policy initiatives, brought people to the table on the front end to help solve solutions, that is something that I think is absolutely a moral and, frankly, economic imperative for a mayor of a major urban city to address and has to happen in this city, but it's not happening. So if you pick the issue, We have world-class talent all across the city, at the neighborhood level, at the academy, in business and philanthropy and civil rights community, and on and on. So we have all the tools at our disposal to take on these tough challenges. But you need a leader who can be a catalyst for change, who sees the need and isn't afraid to roll up her sleeves and get the job done. And that's exactly what I will do as mayor.
So what do you, you are touted as having a very progressive platform, and you've just shared with us some of what you think needs to happen. How would you go about implementing this progressive platform? For example, you talk a lot about fostering an environment and community that is based on inclusion and equality.
Yes. Well, I think it goes to what I've been saying so far, which is, one is recognizing the needs that are out there, recognizing that even in the most distressed communities, there are people who are doing incredible work. Like, I had the opportunity recently to attend a peace march in the Back of the Yards neighborhood, and that has got to be one of the most challenged neighborhoods in our city, both from a crime perspective, economic development. Obviously, they have a significant immigrant population that has all sorts of needs, but yet, people in that community have ownership of their destiny. They are doing everything that they can to change the narrative, and not just by words, but by deeds. I think as mayor, you follow that example and follow their lead and make sure that they have a spotlight on the good things that they're doing and have the resources that they need to be successful, and make sure that the city is there as a partner and welcoming that grassroots activity. That's my sense of a progressive vision that is really manifesting equity and inclusion.
Lori, we covered last week the Obama Presidential Center issue, the opponents to putting that in Jackson Park. Where do you stand on that issue?
Well, look, I think that the fact that the president has chosen Chicago as a location is all a good thing. And frankly, I think that the folks at the grassroots level have really compelled a change in the narrative that is important, and they should be applauded for that work. I mean, obviously, I'll be watching the developments very, very closely to make sure that whatever the final plans are continue to be reflective of the needs of the people in that community. And I feel confident that we will get there.
Lori, we talked a little bit about your work in police misconduct.
Yeah.
If you were mayor of Chicago, how would you have dealt with the Laquan McDonald videotape?
Well, look, obviously, a lot of things that happened with that whole process. It's not just the videotape, but that whole process were wrong. And we spoke, I think, at length about that in the Police Accountability Task Force report, which is why one of the first things that we recommended as part of our work was that we have to have a real, consistent policy about producing videotapes, audio tapes, police reports in these very high-profile actions where lives of community members are directly affected. Our policy in short strokes is you got to get that information out as quickly as possible to the public, and it needs to happen no later than 60 days after the incident happens. We asked the city, as part of our recommendation, to go back, which would have been in 2017, would have been the look back, to see if that 60-day period could be shrunk. We haven't heard anything from them as to whether that is. But more to the point, I think with me as mayor, because I know these issues so intimately, we don't have to wait for a Department of Justice or an Attorney General or even a court. I'm going to make sure that the very good and solid recommendations, both of the task force and the Department of Justice, are implemented, because we need to strengthen the support that we have around our officers, particularly in the areas of training. But it goes beyond that, because if you think about what's going on in our neighborhoods, and you think about the kids for whom, unfortunately, fear is an organizing tool in their lives from the earliest days, We need our police officers to be successful in fulfilling their mission of serving and protecting the community. But we need them, of course, to do it in a constitutional and respectful way where they recognize that respectful engagement with the community is every bit as powerful a tool as their gun and their badge. Steps have been taken and some progress has been made, but not nearly enough. And we still haven't taken on some of the big challenges, systemic challenges that were identified both by the task force and by the Department of Justice. And we're not going to have to wait when I'm mayor. It's going to happen.
Thank you, Lori. I appreciate it.
Great.
Thank you.
Troy LaRavier joining us here on Legal Faceoff. Welcome, Troy.
Thanks for having me.
Troy, thanks for coming in. Tell us why you're running for mayor of Chicago.
Well, thanks. I am running for mayor of Chicago because Chicago does not have a mayor. The bankers have a mayor. The investor class has a mayor. The real estate developers have a mayor. But everyday people, working people, do not have a mayor. They do not have a champion. They don't have an advocate. And I want to make sure they have one in City Hall. People like Henry Feinberg, he has a mayor. This is the venture capitalist who was caught in an email exchange with Rahm Emanuel trying to get him to push for to get rid of workers' pensions. Mm-hmm. And Rahm responds by bragging about the fact that he's the only mayor in the country who eliminated a benefit, got rid of their health care altogether, bragging about this, sent 10,000 city workers into poverty. Those 10,000 city workers don't have a mayor. Henry Feinberg has one. I want to give them and hundreds of thousands of people like them a mayor, or those kids at the National Teachers Academy. Once again, in an email chain, we found that there's a group called the Prairie Alliance, wealthy South Loop residents who wanted the National Teachers Academy building, a beautiful building occupied by low-income, mostly African-American students, one of the best schools in the city, has a 1-plus rating, is fully enrolled. It doesn't meet any of the criteria for school closures. But he's closing that school down that's occupied by these low-income black and brown students so that he can give it to the wealthy residents of the South Loop because he's their mayor. He's the wealthy residents' mayor. He is not a mayor for those kids at the National Teachers Academy or the four Inglewood high schools that he's shutting down. They need a mayor, and I want to be their mayor.
So what do you think are the biggest issues that are confronting Chicago? Now, obviously, we've touched on the schools, we've touched on pensions. What do you think are the other big issues that the city is facing, and what would you like to do to address those issues?
Revenue and reform, particularly reform, corruption, basically, is the biggest issue. It's the one that prevents us from seriously dealing with all of the other ones. The fact that, again, those who are connected, those who are powerful, have influence and get to decide where our city tax dollars go, where our resources go, what problems are going to be addressed and which ones won't. That is the core of our problem. The fact that, for example, we paid $34 million. For a pre-K program that cost $17 million. Mayor took out a $17 million loan, and he's going to pay back the folks, the banks, $34 million. And here's the excuse he gave us. He said that if the pre-K kids, the kids who get pre-K, do better than the kids who don't get it, then we're going to double, you know, their return. They call it pay for success. It's not pay for success. It's pay double for average. Kids who get pre-K, it's already proven that they do better than kids who don't get pre-K. That's like you getting a plumber, asking him how much is it going to be to redo your pipes. He says $10,000, and you say, I'll give you $20,000 if it doesn't leak. Who does that? Who does that with their own money? But he does that consistently with our own money. He's always prioritizing projects that take our tax dollars and send them towards his wealthy campaign contributors. The Tribune had a front page story. 60 of his top 100 campaign contributors all got some kind of contract or kickback or some kind of deal in return for their campaign contributions. He spends over half his days meeting with his donors. And as a result of the fact that they exercise so much influence, all of the other problems that we have to deal with, getting back to your question, get neglected. because we have a city hall. We have someone in city hall who is a mayor for a small class of people, but not for the rest of us. So I think that's the first one. I think the issue with police accountability is huge. Of course, as an educator, I believe the issue with our schools is huge. Our school system right here in Chicago, we are ranked 857th out of 858 school districts in the state of Illinois in the ratio of students to certified staff. What that means is that the average Illinois school with 600 kids has 58 professional educators to serve those 600 kids. Do you know how many professional educators serve 600 kids in Chicago? 37. 21 fewer, not 21 fewer than the top Illinois schools. We have 21 fewer staff than the average Illinois school. That is severe underinvestment in those students. Go ahead.
Just turning to a different subject, Troy, we found out yesterday that COPPA came up with a ruling in a shooting that was unjustified. They found that Officer Robert Realmo will face potential firing resulting from a fatal 2015 shooting of a teenager who was carrying a baseball bat. What are your feelings on how to deal with the issue of how the police are interacting with citizens of Chicago? Also, how will you deal with violence and gun violence in particular if elected mayor of Chicago?
So my approach to most issues is, what does the research say works? You know, even in education, where I'm an expert, we always go back to the research. What has worked nationally? What works locally? And in terms of gun violence, we start with the Department of Justice report. Right? They spent months, if not an entire year, following the CP around, going into the data. They came closer to the problems than any of us ever will. So let's take a look at what they found. And what they found was, number one, a pattern and practice of an unconstitutional use of force. Undeniable. Number two and three, which were basically implied recommendations, is that there are no accountability systems, no effective accountability systems whatsoever to hold officers accountable when they do use unconstitutional, when they do engage in an unconstitutional use of force. And three, and very importantly, is that there's a lack of training, a lack of supervision, and even more importantly, a lack of support. And when we say support, we're not talking about rah, rah, rah kind of support. We're talking about building their capacity to do their jobs correctly. And that's one of the things that gets missed in these accountability conversations. Even in schools, there's this teacher accountability conversation. We helped Blaine become the number one school in the city of Chicago, not because we led with accountability, but we led with capacity building. Building teachers' capacity to meet the expectations by which we were holding them accountable. And it's the same with police officers. We have to build their capacity to meet the expectations, to serve citizens respectfully, justly, fairly, to meet the expectations by which we hold them accountable. And when we attempt to build their capacity and they don't respond to that, there have to be accountability systems that say there are going to be consequences for violating the rights of our citizens. There are going to be consequences for treating citizens unfairly or treating our residents unfairly and unjustly.
So, why don't you share your thoughts? Obviously, immigration, very, very debated topic. Obviously, Chicago, sanctuary city, you know, hub of conversation about that. Why don't you share your thoughts on how you propose making Chicago a true sanctuary?
It's an excellent question. I think the examples of it all across our city, right after Trump got elected and instituted one of those travel bans, I went to a school on the north side. And, you know, the mayor talked about all this stuff about we're going to be a sanctuary city. But they showed what it's really like. They had an assembly where they talked about how welcoming their school was going to be in a very concrete way. They brought attorneys and advocacy groups in to talk to immigrant parents and families about their legal responsibilities, steps they should take in case they're pulled over or in case that they're taken into custody. That is support. They were out there in the school providing support and services to families, not just doing lip service about we're not going to cooperate with the police or with the feds if they ask us for anything. But they were taking steps, concrete steps, to provide support for these families. But that was just that school. If we were truly a welcoming city, that would have been a citywide phenomenon. And things like that would have been a citywide phenomenon.
That is Troy LaRavier, running for mayor. The website to learn more, troyforchicago.com. Troy, thanks for joining us. And when you get elected, you better come back.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Troy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lead it off with Jamal Green, who's running for mayor here in Chicago. He joins us as we kick things off.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Jamal, several weeks ago, you announced that you were running for mayor. You are one of a whole slew of folks that are running against Rahm Emanuel. You are the youngest mayoral candidate. You're 22, and you're known, as Ben said, for your community activism, particularly with the Black Lives Matter movement. What made you decide to throw your hat into the ring for mayor?
So I'm not just with my activism, and I'm not affiliated with the Black Lives Matter organization, but with the growing number of activists around the country who are standing up to political figures such as Rahm Emanuel. And I've been on the front lines in the progressive community as well, as I was a surrogate for Bernie Sanders and traveled around the country speaking before him, talking about how we're going to move forward in so many issues that directly affect us. So being a surrogate, representing families, seeing these issues, seeing how leadership was not quick to address so many of these problems like violence and police reform and economic inequalities, they're not willing to step up and become and actually have leadership that we really need in this city. And I looked for who would be the best candidate to support for mayor, and I could not find one. And it was just a little divine for me to go ahead and jump into this race, and that's why I decided to be that person who has already been leading in these communities, but taking it to City Hall to be a voice for all of these, for all communities in the city of Chicago that are being, that have so many issues plaguing these, their communities.
Jamal, there's at least 8 candidates running for mayor. We've had on a couple of them, including Troy LaRavier. There's also Willie Wilson, Gary McCarthy, Dorothy Brown, Paul Vallis, among others. How do you plan to, separate yourself from the pack? And how would you become a voice on other issues? As mentioned, one of your core issues is dealing with what you perceive as the inequality in the treatment of police and some members of the community. How would you also speak to other issues to distinguish yourself from the rest of the candidates?
Yeah. So firstly, I'm glad that there are so many candidates in this race. That means that especially all these candidates represent different communities, different broad spectrum of issues. And it's an amazing thing to see everybody come to forum. I mean, you know, everybody won't make it all the way through, but just to have these voices is amazing. How we're going to set ourselves apart is we have, so I'm not just been talking about anti-violence. I've not just been talking about police reform. I've been very vocal and the progressive light of talking about economic inequalities, of talking about education and how we're going to move forward with that, talking about health care. And we're just going to continue to make sure that those platform pieces. So we presented the most progressive platform thus far than any candidate in this race. And this platform, which is on our site at greenforchicago.com, addresses so many different issues. And people can read them. We're going to unify different community and community groups around these issues and amplify those their voices, because it's important that we not just talk about one issue, not just talk about it. It's so many issues that people are affected by all over the city. And we're going to make sure young people are talking about this. We're going to make sure we're having town halls, whether it's in schools or in colleges and universities. We're going to make sure that we have a platform for everyone to voice their concerns. and unify them to go around this campaign and organize with us.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your platform as it relates to education?
Yeah, as it relates to education, we have a couple things. So one of the things is, of course, we have to invest in neighborhood schools. I think that's one of the most important things. We continue to not have adequate funding and resources for these schools. And once the enrollment is low because parents don't want to put their kid in a school that doesn't have the proper resources, then we shut them down. All right, that plan has been going on so many years, and it needs to end. Schools right now, they have 40 kids a classroom who don't learn the same, a lack of staff members, where the average is 56, and we got 37, a lack of clinical staff members, where we may have one person that's licensed, a licensed therapist possibly in the schools. A lot of schools don't have that. And so when you have a school that isn't doesn't have the leadership that makes sure that school make sure kids can actually grow and thrive in that school, then you're preparing that school for failure. We have to change that process. We have to then have a higher education model in which, well, higher model we are presenting as a triangle initiative, where it's not just higher education, but it's trade school and entrepreneurial boot camp. So kids will be able to go to community college, trade school, entrepreneurial boot camp for free, and all they have to do is community service so that we can create tomorrow's leaders. We can create tomorrow's kids who want to create the new technology, who wants to fill these tech these trade jobs that are empty, who want to open up their own companies. We have to create tomorrow leadership, and that's what our education plan is doing.
Jamal, you're 22 years old. You are trying to raise money to open a youth center in Bronzeville, targeting youth from 12 to 24. We have covered on Legal Face-Off the Never Again movement that rose up following the Parkland shootings. Why do you think now is the right time for someone who is relatively inexperienced, not just in politics, but in life, such as yourself, to become the mayor of the fourth largest city in the country?
Yeah, let me correct you real quick. As far as Majesty All-Stars and the Youth Center building that we purchased was in Gresham on 79th and Ashland. And I stepped down as CEO to run this campaign, so the program is still going on.
Oh, great.
But as far as the youth around the country who are stepping up, it is our time to make sure that we are preparing the next generation future. All right. I think a lot of times we lose sight in the fact that a lot of the decisions that politicians make today is drastically going to affect the next generation instead of things that we may see tomorrow. And it's up to us to step up and make sure that the next generation of kids have better schools. The next generation of kids have mental health facilities. Next generation of kids don't have to be scared to walk in their own communities without being gunned down. The next generation is not dealing with so much corruption and pay-to-play politics. If we don't give Chicago a new slate, we're dooming the next generation and continuing the cycle. It is up to us and young people across the country to step up and take a stand. The old way has not been working. The old way has been going on so many years. Now this is the time. This is the best time where we have a political environment like this and people that are fed up with the state of politics to give a new slate. We can do that right now. Fresh ideas, with fresh plans, with fresh faces, progressive faces. We can do it.
I couldn't agree with you more, Jamal. Just promise me you'll join us after you you get the position.
Yes, definitely.
Fantastic. Jamal Green, mayoral candidate. To learn more about Jamal's campaign, you can visit greenforchicago.com. Jamal, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Comp Alliance is unique in the workers' compensation industry in their ability to provide comprehensive managed care services from initiation of a claim to settlement, including 24/7 nurse triage, URAC accredited medical and vocational case management. Their suite of innovative MSP compliance solutions, including fully customizable MSA programs, professional administration, and additional cost avoidance services, simplifies the claims management process. Their focus is retaining accountability, responsibility,
responsiveness and quality while tailoring their services to meet your needs. For your managed care support needs, contact Comp Alliance online at compalliance.com. Again, compalliance.com.